If you have a question, I'm going to ask you, please, please make it be an actual question.
Welcome to Geeks Without God with Tim Wick, Nick Glover, and Molly Glover.
We're geeks, we're geeks, we're geeks without God. We're geeks without God. We don't recognize moral authority. We don't accept divine superiority. We're geeks, geeks without God.
This week's Geeks Without God was recorded live at the Skeptech Conference. It's an all-star panel featuring Greta Christina, Tim Fairley, Zach Wienersmith, and Chelsea Dufresne.
We're geeks, we're geeks, we're geeks without God. We're geeks, we're geeks, we're geeks without God. We're geeks, geeks without God.
Welcome to Geeks Without God. I am your host, Tim Wick. I am joined by my co-host, Molly Glover.
Hi.
And Nick Glover.
Hey, that's me.
And we are appearing live at the Skeptech Conference 2013.
Stuff.
Very well done.
Like
I didn't even prompt him to do that ahead of time. That was amazing. We are joined by a panel of prestigious individuals. I'm going to introduce them. First is Greta Christina. Yeah. Greta Christina is the author of Why Are You Atheists So Angry? 99 Things That Piss Off the Godless, and the editor of several other books, including Paying For It, A Guide by Sex Workers for Their Clients. She also writes Greta Christina's blog on the Freethought Blog Network. You might as well applaud now. You don't know how awesome she's going to be later. So that's a good thing. Next to Greta is Chelsea Dufresne, a last-minute ad, ladies and gentlemen. Just this morning, she didn't know she was going to be on this panel. So we're really excited to have her. She's one of the organizers of the Skeptech Conference. And we really are happy that she decided to have us here and sit on our panel. Next to Chelsea is Tim Farley. He is the creator of What's the Harm, and he's also currently a research fellow at the James Randi Educational Foundation, which sounds really impressive.
Yeah, it sounds impressive.
And finally, Zach Wienersmith. He is the author and illustrator of the award-winning webcomic Saturday Morning Breakfast Cereal. So we're really happy to have the four of you with us here this evening, and we've got some questions to sort of kick things off, because the topic of this convention is skepticism and technology. So we're going to ask you questions about skepticism and technology. I know that sounds like kind of a cop-out, but it seemed like the easiest way to do this. So we're Molly, do you want to do the first question?
I do. All right, so what is your personal definition of skepticism, and do you think it precludes religion? And I'm going to start with Zach, because he's to my right.
I suppose I think of skepticism as something like the belief that empiricism is a reasonable thing to throw at any topic. And I'd say it probably precludes religion. I mean, I'm cool with the idea of a big tent for a group, but I personally don't see how you can throw empiricism at God and have it not stop right there.
So it's difficult to be both a skeptic and a religious person in your mind?
If you're applying standards equally, I think so.
Okay. I have to say I agree with you. So that's it.
Really, you're just going to go and agree with somebody right off the bat?
Well, I do.
You have to sometimes.
I thought we were the moderators. Are we supposed to share our own opinions?
She's easy.
Oh.
I tricked her into marrying me. I mean, come on.
It's good radio. If you can see. Okay. Tim, how do you feel about this question? What's your personal definition of skepticism?
I have a definition that's a little bit unusual. I started thinking about it in terms of how to pitch it to someone that they would understand it. And so many of the definitions are kind of complex, and you get into critical thinking and empiricism and a naturalistic worldview, and people's eyes glaze over and they walk off. So I came up with we're all nerds here, a Venn diagram, of course, with two circles. Nice. And the two circles are science education and consumer protection. And at least the parts of skepticism that I like to concentrate on are in the intersection of those two things. How thinking about science and the scientific method will help you not waste your money on stupid stuff. Potentially, I think that could include religion. Personally, I don't focus on those things. I tend to focus more on alt med and stuff like that.
Quackery.
Quackery is a big thing. Vaccine denial, those sorts of things.
Ah, yes.
But I find that's an easy way to pitch skepticism to someone who doesn't know what you're talking about, because the two things are both positive things. Instead of having to talk about what you don't believe, you talk about what you do believe. You believe in science, that it's a great way to learn about the universe, and you believe in protecting consumers from bad ideas and bad products. And, well, those two things are good, so the intersection of those two things must be pretty good.
Excellent. Thank you. Chelsea?
Well, I guess I see skepticism as more of an evidence-based, falsifiable method that you apply to a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I'm a little bit suspicious as always identifying as a skeptic. I think it actually leads you to be unskeptical in some respects, because you automatically assume that obviously you've done your thinking because you identify as a skeptic.
That's interesting. The label itself
Well, some people can use it lazily, I think, whereas others use it legitimately.
Can you think of any examples of someone using it that's you consider to be...
I know a lot of skeptics who still think antioxidants are going to automatically save them from cancer.
I think my favorite example of that would be like Bigfoot hunters. Like ghost hunters are like, you haven't looked at the real proof.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you think that precludes religion? Do you feel that you can be both a skeptic and a religious person?
Well, I think you could, but I mean, obviously cognitive dissonance is involved to some degree. I think you can, the way you do it is you recognize that faith must be separate from your skepticism. And so it's schools, non-overlapping magisterium, basically.
Excellent, thank you. And Greta, your answer.
I feel like I shouldn't have a 25 words or less answer.
How many words do you need?
To what skepticism is, but I'm operating on 4 hours of sleep, so I kind of don't have that. I would say that skepticism is it's a method rather than identity, ideally at least, and to some extent a philosophy of life, and that skepticism is the philosophy or method that prioritizes the evidence and reason over other ways of understanding the world when it comes to understanding the objective external world. You know, not when it comes to subjective questions like, do I really like chocolate or do I love my wife? We talk about, places where skepticism shouldn't be applied, and I don't know that there is a, evidence-based, way of approaching that, but that when it comes to questions of what is literally true in the real world, that we prioritize, evidence and good critical thinking skills, and also that we apply self-criticism, that we apply the understanding that our cognitive biases and so on, play into our understanding of the world and try to allow for that. And I think that almost by definition that excludes religion, because religion is by definition faith. It's faith in things for which you have no good evidence. And in most religions, it doesn't just say that believing things that you have no good reason to think are true is acceptable. It actually raises it to the level of a virtue. And that is in 180 degrees diametrically opposite to skepticism. Now, in a day-to-day practical sense, can you be a skeptic and be a religious believer? Yes, of course, but you can't be a good skeptic. Or at least you're not applying your skepticism correctly to that area.
Or perhaps a good religious believer.
Or a good religious believer. There are skeptics who believe, there are self-identified skeptics who, apply their skepticism well to most topics, and then, they have their handful of things that they have blind spots about, and that's probably true for all of us. In a day-to-day sense, you can believe in God or the soul and be a skeptic, but you're not doing it right.
Thank you, guys. That's great.
Hey, Molly, do you have an answer to that question?
I do, actually. My personal definition is really similar, kind of a conglomeration, but a lot similar to Tim's here. I think that it is about, you know, looking for the evidentiary proof in the world and really trying very different, like, lots of scientific analysis of things, and going through your own steps, your own scientific process, which, you know, shouldn't include a step of prayer, like the creationist Bible study we went to thing, the creationist science fair that had that, but more of a, just, you know, you're trying to make sure that you are only accepting fact. Like, a lot of people on the internet will pass around image memes and that have statistics, and I'll ask, where do these come from? And they don't know. And to me, that's unacceptable. Like, that's my skeptic, I feel, coming out and saying, I demand citation, I demand evidence, I need to see actual, facts aren't subjective. So I do think it precludes religion, but that's just a, for me, I'm with Greta, I think they're diametrically opposed.
I thought about 25 words or less. my 25 words or less has to do less with the methodology and more with the philosophy. I think that skepticism is the philosophy that reality matters. It's the philosophy that reality is more important than anything else, and that it's especially more important than anything we could make up about it, and that when we're trying to answer any question about the world, our number one question has to be, is it true? Is it real? And that's a philosophy, and I think it's also, to some extent, it's a discipline, it's a practice.
Yeah, I agree with that. Tim, did you want to ask a question?
Well, I'd be happy to. Thanks for bringing it
all
up.
All right.
I would like to ask our panel, what led you personally to self-define as a skeptic, if, in fact, you do self-define as a skeptic? Why don't we start with Greta, because you're right next to me, and it's kind of like what Molly did, only from the other side.
At some point, we have to start in the middle, but...
That's Nick's job.
I would say...
What? That was not dirty. What? All right.
Everything's dirty.
I would say my process of identifying as a skeptic was somewhat gradual. Not coincidentally, my process of self-identifying as a skeptic went hand in hand with my process of letting go of spiritual beliefs. It was a very gradual process. You know, I had all these kind of new agey spiritual beliefs, but I was also always very interested primarily in how the mind works, and I was very interested in neurology and neuropsychology, and I started, you know, reading about them, and the process of reading about neurology and neuropsychology and how the mind works really enticed me to let go of any idea that I might have of having a soul. But it was kind of a gradual process. The big door opening, apart from neurology and neuropsychology, I think was starting to read Skeptical Inquirer magazine. And because they were applying skepticism and this methodology of, you know, hey, let's actually, gee, when you're asking a question about the world, why don't you actually look at the evidence? Wow, what a concept. They were applying it to things that I already agreed with them about, you know, things like, you know, vaccine denialism and global warming denialism and Bigfoot and so on. But then they were also applying it to questions that I didn't agree with them on. And I kind of had to say, you know, it's like if I'm going to accept their methodology about all this stuff, I kind of have to be willing to question my own beliefs about all this other stuff, like reincarnation and life after death and so on. But I would say it was a gradual process. It wasn't like there was one thing that happened overnight.
Chelsea, why don't you tell us what you think?
I think I would agree with Greta. For me, that it went step by step with my atheism. And what led me to my skepticism was really, it actually had nothing to do with science, even though that's really what enforced it later on. So I used to ride horses professionally. And when I was doing that, all of my bosses that I was working for were all openly gay, and it was, within that community, it's basically completely accepted. And so even though I was raised Roman Catholic, we never really talked about being gay, and it was just one of those issues we completely ignored. And so when I got to high school, a Catholic high school, and I learned that, like, the Catholic religion's actual beliefs about being gay, I was shocked, and I thought they were really stupid. And extremely bigoted, and so I ended up rejecting my faith not long after that, because if they could be extremely bigoted with how they believed in God, then you kind of have to ask, fundamentally, how sound is your thinking to begin with? After that, I guess what reinforced it was the online scientific community. So that kind of planted the seed, that social justice aspect. But then science took and ran with it.
Great. Tim?
When I was a kid, I was big into astronomy, and I read a lot of UFO books, too, and a little bit of Bermuda Triangle and stuff like that. And I thought that that stuff was really interesting, but as I read more about astronomy, some of the things didn't quite add up, and the details didn't quite match, and it's like, well, I don't know about this. And time went on, and I sort of let that stuff go aside. And years later, I was a fan of, and still am a fan of, Penn and Teller. I had seen their show a few times, and then they had their TV show. And they were constantly promoting this event in Las Vegas, or at least every year when it came up, called the Amazing Meeting. And one year I finally decided, you know, that sounds really cool, and maybe I could meet Penn and Teller and meet these other people that go to this meeting. And I went to it, and it was pretty cool. It was a skeptic conference like this, met a lot of really cool people, saw people who were doing really interesting things relating to skepticism, and decided that, you know, hey, maybe this is who I am. Maybe this is the community that I'm part of, and set out to find a project that I could be involved with. And that's how I eventually came up with the idea a few months later of What's the Harm, and it's all snowballed since then. I have like 19 different projects.
Yeah, Zach, what do you think?
I don't know if I have a good story. I think I don't
make one up. That's what we do.
I was saving orphans in Antarctica.
Damn it! That's what I was gonna say.
I was kidnapped by a Yeti.
Yeah, and he taught me of skepticism.
Oh, cruel irony!
Wow. Yeah, I don't believe in him anymore, but. He had some good ideas.
Yeah. As soon as you mastered skepticism, he disappeared in a poof of...
That would be amazing.
That's good.
Yeah, I don't remember ever having a defined philosophy in opposition to skepticism.
That's fair. It's a fair answer. I'll take that.
It can just happen. You don't need a story about it. They can just... You could always have thought that way, more or less, too, or at least it could go so far back that there's not really a moment, you know, when it, pardon me, an epiphany, when it happens, it can just be so gradual that you don't even notice or have been there all along. It was always inside you, Zach. You were always a skeptic all along.
That's what the Yeti said.
High school debate did it for me. That's my quick answer. High school debate, like seeing, having to be, being forced to look at both sides of all the issues and come up with evidence on both sides, like led me to realize you could find any evidence you looked for. So that meant you had to really look for you had to really pay attention to what people were telling you.
And discovering that not all evidence is equal?
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
What did it for me was Cosmos. I watched that with my dad on PBS. It was the early 80s, I think. And mm-hmm. and when Carl Sagan said extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, I was like, what? That's brilliant. And that kind of I guess that wrapped it up for God, as they say.
Did he have any evidence for that? No.
Just my memory, and that's faulty. Nick, why don't you do the next question?
Sure. So what, if any, technology do you find detrimental to skepticism or to society as a whole?
Holy crap.
And we'll start with Chelsea. No pressure.
I'm going to take the obvious answer and say nuclear weapons are probably detrimental to society. And I'm including science with technology because I want to take the easy answer.
Sure. That's fine. No one will fault you for that. I can't put you on the spot.
I just want to seem smart. That's fine.
You're just going to toss the nukes out there right at the beginning. So the rest of us can't use it.
This is the bar I'm setting, just so you know. So for the very simple reason of humanity destroying itself and the planet is probably a bad idea.
Yeah, in general, I'd say.
Yeah.
You know, that's where I keep all my stuff.
I'm willing to put myself in the against column on that one.
Yeah. Tim?
I don't know. With nukes off the table, a particular technology. But my mind keeps going to climate change, so I guess fossil fuels? Would that count as a technology?
Sure.
To society and probably not to skepticism.
Detrimental skepticism?
Fossil fuels are ruining skepticism.
If only skeptics would stop using coal.
That's right.
I think it's huffing.
I don't know. Most of the skeptics I know use wind power. But
I would point out, I was at an event last week that a bunch of skeptics were at, and I ran into a climate change denier who ostensibly was a skeptic. And I've had that happen at a few different events. So it's an interesting problem. Where it's the, you know, what we were talking about before, about how skeptics don't apply, don't rigorously apply the principles of skepticism to everything. And they have these blind spots, and for some people that's climate change.
Greta?
Well, I'm going to go out on a limb here. I'm going to talk about a technology that I think has both helped and hurt skepticism, and that's the internet.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Obviously the internet has been hugely helpful in disseminating skeptical ideas and also building a skeptical community and a skeptical movement, you know, but gosh, it's also really awesome at disseminating really bad ideas and very unquestioned ideas. And people do have this tendency to think, you know, because, you know, my aunt sent me the email forward about how cinnamon and the color red will cure your arthritis. I think that was what
Wait,
it was.
There
was
something.
Let me check that. I'll look that up.
Where's your evidence?
I think you have an article on PubMed.
Yeah. Everybody's out there Googling.
Well, all the climate change deniers are getting their fuel from the internet too, for sure. There's no microfiche that they're looking it up on.
So people do have this unfortunate tendency to believe what they read and to believe what people they trust tell them and to believe what authority figures tell them. And, you know, these are cognitive biases we all have, but not everybody understands these cognitive biases and not everybody understands the kinds of ideas that are likely, that are plausible, and the kinds of ideas that maybe you should go look up on Snopes before passing them on to 100 of your closest friends and relatives. I would have to say that.
It's like it's the faster and more efficient means of communicating ideas, good ideas and bad ideas, good information and bad information. Mm-hmm.
The internet gives you an opportunity to say something before you actually have to think about it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Zach?
Well, actually, I want to add one more thing to that, which is that the internet also tends to dial up the heat. You know, people, when they're having conversations on the internet, have a tendency to forget that they're talking to another human being, and therefore, sort of, you know, it's this combination of losing compassion and dialing up the rage.
Yeah.
And I think that can often be detrimental to, an actual skeptical exchange of ideas and examining the evidence.
That?
I don't know if I would single something out because I think technology per se is double-edged. I don't know if there's any technology you could name that doesn't have a good and bad use. I mean, even nuclear weapons, I would say, have had good uses in terms of pacification after 1945. And fossil fuels, I think you wouldn't deny, have been responsible for the Western lifestyle, which I enjoy. I enjoyed my plane trip here.
I did too.
Yeah. So, I mean,
I think...
That's true. I don't know. I'm optimistic about things like the internet, though, because at least for me personally, I feel like a lot of social issues have swung in the direction that I believe is right in the era of the internet, and I'm hopeful that had something to do with it. The amount of argumentation that regular people experience on a daily basis has increased, and I think that's valuable.
I kind of think for myself along the same lines as the internet as an option. I think not so much a technology, but the science of statistics. I mean, it can be very misleading. A lot of people don't understand how statistics really work, what's valuable, what makes a good statistic, what makes bad or bullshit statistic. And I feel like that's what I would say, you know, personally. I feel like it's harmful to skepticism because people don't understand it. And I think the more we can push that understanding, the better it'll work out.
Great. You know what I think we ought to do? I think we got about 10 more minutes. I think actually we can see if anybody has any questions for any or all of our panel. So I'm going to throw it open to the audience. If anybody's got a question, raise your hand. I will call on you and then I will repeat your question. This gentleman in the front is kind enough to be the first to ask a question. Please go ahead, sir. And can you say your name for the record?
My name is Abby. I just have a question for anyone who's willing to answer. I wonder if you guys see any relationship between skepticism and happiness. And if there is, has there been any skeptical or scientific study to suggest that skeptics are more happy or less happy?
Okay, so he wants to know if there's any relationship between skepticism and happiness and wants to know if we know of any scientific studies that might prove or not prove that.
All I have is confirmation bias. I'm pretty happy.
I can confirm that bias.
Actually, I've seen studies showing, this isn't about skepticism exactly, I have seen studies that show that people with religious belief on average tend to be happier than people without it. However, that difference disappears almost entirely when people without religious belief have a community. And so, you know, you see a lot of statistics showing that, you know, religious believers are so much happier than atheists, therefore God exists. but what they found is that that difference really dries, apparently the reason for that difference is that religious believers are more likely to have a community because most people are religious, and that as atheists get a community, that difference disappears. Speaking for myself, I think it's a little bit of a complicated question because there are certainly ideas that made me happy that I've had to let go of, you know, as a skeptic. There are ideas that, you know, they confirmed my view of the world and, you know, they made me happy and, you know, and this sort of discipline that I'm trying to apply to my life of believing what's true and not what I want to believe. Sometimes that means I don't get to believe things. But the upside of that is I feel like I have, the best way I can put it, is a more intimate relationship with reality. I feel more in touch with reality and more connected with the world around me and more part of it in a way that I didn't have when I was in this constant state of denial and cognitive dissonance and lying to myself about how the world worked.
Yeah, I would say God made me really uncomfortable. and when I finally let go of that idea, and this is more about atheism than skepticism, but it's the same kind of thing. When I finally let go of an idea that made me very uncomfortable, yes, I also let go of some things that I kind of liked, but in general, I feel more comfortable with the world because I'm not dealing with this idea that really always bugged me. That's my answer. Anybody else?
Well, I guess I can apply this more. I'm almost in a scientific sense, in terms of, say, what you read in the news. I guess my skepticism, my skepticism has made it easier to interpret new technologies and new happenings in more of a neutral way. For example, if you buy into every new claim that is ever made at any newsstand, it's a constant life of disappointment because those almost never will those claims actually be true or will they really live up to them. And so if you approach it from the beginning with a skeptical eye, I think it leads to, I don't know, a more neutral outlook. So,
yeah. I kind of see two sides to it. One is that, yeah, if you personally are living a life as a skeptic and being rational, you can be happier. But if you're sort of involved in the movement, if you're out there doing skeptical things and trying to interact with believers in whatever online, it can be very frustrating because there's always some new thing. You know, just when you think one thing has gone by the wayside, some new form of alt-med or whatever pops up out of the sewers and is being sold to people, and it can get you know a little bit you know wearing that, oh my God, does it ever stop that someone is trying to sell some new form of snake oil to the public? So I don't know. We can move on, or do you have an answer, Zach?
Well, I just wanted to say I think it's worth parsing the question a little because we have this idea that happiness is necessarily the goal of life and that we have some ability to calculate it. which is a fairly modern conceit that starts with utilitarianism. And I think there are all sorts of teleologies you could pick other than happiness that would give you an experience you could look back on and be satisfied with, maybe even more satisfied than maximum happiness seeking. So, you know, I'm not even convinced that happiness has a bearing on how one should live one's life.
That's really interesting because I can think of times where I was, you know, without a doubt, unhappy, but I'm glad they happened because they lent me a new introspection and gave me more empirical evidence that I could draw upon when thinking of things later and doing comparisons.
If nothing else, contrast for when you are happy. I mean, that's worth something.
Yeah, not to quote the enemy, but Augustine said that, he knew that memories weren't, as we might say, like just logged as memory, because sometimes you remember a sad thing happily or a happy thing sadly.
If you're going to quote one, Augustine's one to go with.
We have another question. That hand went up first. Yes, sir. Yeah.
Okay, so you've had several mentions of climate change, and that's one of my personal crusades. but I can arguably say that most people here actually don't know the full theory behind climate change. Yeah, we know carbon dioxide causes increases in global temperature, but we don't really know the physics behind it. So there's an element of trust behind the method. So it's not so much a question of do we trust the scientific method, but do we trust the scientific community? So where do you think the line should be drawn? At what point is trust in the method, not so, you go beyond it and say, yeah, there are enough number of people performing the science and I'm willing to believe them.
So I'm going to try and rephrase this.
Since most of us don't understand the actual physics because we're not physicists or actual climatologists, where do we draw the line and what we just put our trust in science and what scientists are telling us as opposed to what we know for ourselves to be true because of what we've learned and what we've educated ourselves with?
There you go.
That's what I thought.
Feels like that's an answer Tim might want to tackle.
Well, yeah, and it's a fundamental problem because science is getting, gets increasingly complex as the years go on, and there's a point at which you have to rely on experts, and you have to have a way of vetting whether that person is an expert and whether you should trust them. One of the important things in any scientific thing is the volume or the overall community consensus, so that I'm not deciding that climate change is happening because that one guy up there wrote a paper. I believe that climate change is happening because thousands of papers have been written about various aspects of it, including tree rings and ice cores and carbon levels in the atmosphere and atmospheric measurements on the ground and atmospheric measurements from satellites. And all that data, while not perfect, and there are flaws in it, and it isn't an absolutely perfect picture, it all definitely points to the fact that the climate is changing, and it does seem to be, at least in part, our fault. And I think that when you look at the sum total of it, you can just say that it's overwhelming. Maybe 15 years ago you couldn't say that, but now you can say it because of the volume of material that's out there. And then, of course, when you say that to a climate change denier, they start getting in very close to conspiracy theory type stuff of, well, you know, it's because the scientists are all in cahoots with each other. But it falls apart very quickly, like any conspiracy theory, because of just, you know, if you know anything about scientists and how science is done and how at each other's throats they often are, wanting to prove each other wrong all the time, you'd know that it's just not happening. And then, you know, they get into the money argument. They're just doing it to get grants. And I always say, show me one climate science scientist driving a Bentley.
Can I ask you if there's... Do you feel like, especially with a lot of denialists, they are looking at the evidence from 15 years ago and kind of ignoring any of the new evidence because that fits more with their worldview?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of cherry picking going on. Almost every time you see somebody showing a graph or a chart or quoting a figure, they're cherry picking some part of a larger data set that suits their story.
Evil statistics.
Mm-hmm. So I I actually do think that this is a difficult question. This whole question of, you know, on a day-to-day basis, to some extent, you know, to a great extent, you know, as lay people, we, you know, trusting in science, even though it, you know, we have these sort of high-minded ideals about, oh, it means, you know, examining the evidence and you know, reason and not taking anything, you know, not distrusting authority, on a day-to-day sense, it does look to some extent like an argument from authority, like we're just trusting authority figures. But I think that it's important to understand that part of this, it's not part of the scientific method, and part of why we value the scientific method has to do with peer review. And so, you know, I'm not just trusting, you know, the scientists, the scientific consensus, because, you know, they're standing up there with authority figures and letters after their name. You know, I'm trusting them because in the past, this process, including the process of peer review, has found itself to be very effective. And, you know, the results show. Now, I do also think, that being said, that it's worth being aware of and applying a skeptical eye to the kinds of mistakes and the kinds of blind spots that scientists and the science, you know, have shown in the past. You know, things like, you know, researchers who are being funded by somebody who's motivated for them to find a particular answer tend to find that answer, even with the best intentions possible. Mm-hmm. You know, things like blindness about their own sexism, things like blindness about their own racism, blindness about their own classism, and so on. You know, we could probably come up with examples all day. So I do think that it is worth applying that eye and saying, okay, given the history of how, you know, what do you know, scientists are human beings and, you know, they're subject to cognitive biases as everybody else, you know, are the results that they're coming up with jibing with this tendency towards, you know, towards these cognitive biases that we've seen in the past?
When I have a claim in front of me that I can in no way address, let's say if somebody made a claim about theoretical physicists, I'm an evolutionary biologist, I can't address that problem necessarily. The way to, I guess, I critique it is by evaluating the rigorousness of their own self-policing within that community. And so it does sort of touch on peer review, but it sort of extends beyond that. What's the community's reaction to that claim being made? Because peer review, okay, so for anyone who's submitted a paper, it can, you know, it can be kind of a crapshoot. You can submit a paper and have three fantastic reviews, or you can have three horrible reviews that think you're just the worst idiot on the planet and you should just stop doing science immediately. And we'd like to think that that doesn't happen and that only good ideas get passed on, but that's quite obviously not true. And so I would say always go back to the water community and how they interpret the evidence.
Okay, I see a hand up there. Is it a question or a comment?
Question.
Okay, what's your question, sir?
How do we distinguish between entire fields that are legitimate or illegitimate?
How do we distinguish between entire fields that are legitimate or illegitimate? All right, who wants to take that one?
Just a quick one-word answer. I don't know, results. Hmm? Like if you look at, you know, homeopathy, how many cases of cancer is that cured? None, because it doesn't do shit.
I think it's the case that every single field has a bullshit wing. Even fields like hard physics has a wing of bullshit to it, which is on the interpretive side, and not completely. I mean, you have to make interpretations of results, but it's not as if you won't find people speculating in every field in a way that's improper, or at least not scientific. I mean, to an extent, that's how science gets expanded. I suppose homeopathy we could write off. But to an extent, though, it's a human categorization. I mean, you could say, well, there's chemistry and there's these bullshit chemists called the homeopathy people.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, because when you say field, that's just a human category. You know, I mean, you know how it is in academia. People will say, you know, I'm doing biology and chemistry, so I'm interdisciplinary. You know? And we have all these categories. I think it's kind of silly to decide who's in and who's out based on that, because you could just recategorize them in any sort of structure you wanted.
Okay, we're running out of time, but I think we'll do one more question. Oh my God, everybody raised their hand at once. This guy right over here, what do you want?
I'm just curious about one think about the connection between skepticism and atheism.
So you the connection between skepticism and atheism. So who's got an answer on that?
I think we were all kind of talking earlier about how skepticism should automatically lead to atheism, but certainly there are people who I don't want to say they're bad skeptics, but they're applying their skepticism poorly. But it's also the case that there are some atheists who have come to their atheism not through, you know, careful examination of the evidence and, you know, careful thought processes, but through, you know, more emotional, you know, things, or just because it's how they were raised. And they didn't, you know, this is how they were raised and they didn't really think about it. So I think that while ideally every skeptic should be an atheist and every atheist should be a skeptic, that's not always in reality going to happen.
I'm sorry.
I guess I would highlight the difference between a method and a position taken. So atheism is a position taken. Skepticism would be a method. So atheism as a method doesn't really make much sense to me. And so I think those who arrive upon their atheism, you obviously can't automatically assume that they arrive there via skepticism. Skepticism is one path, and I think it's the best path, but, you know, it's not an island with one bridge.
Yeah, I would agree with what's been said. We have a skeptic group in Atlanta, and we have a whole huge number of atheist groups in Atlanta. And every time I've had any interactions with the folks in the atheist groups, a lot of them are great folks and could be called skeptics too. And a lot of them are into the craziest things, you know, crystal healing and homeopathy and all this stuff. And they occasionally wander into our skeptic meeting and get mad at us. It's definitely true that there's an intersection there, but not everybody gets everything from or follows it out to its logical conclusion and buys into both completely.
There's a phrase that a previous guest of ours on the podcast, Ron Bauman, used, and it's faith-based atheist. and I think that works. I mean, you can, atheism is like a destination. It's a belief you might have.
Does a faith-based atheist qualify for federal funding?
Tax exempt.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's entirely possible to be a non-skeptic atheist, and I suppose it's possible to be a non-atheist skeptic if you're really good at compartmentalizing things and don't mind the cognitive dissonance. I feel that, you know, being a skeptic would make you an atheist, but the opposite isn't necessarily true.
I think atheism brought me to skepticism because I didn't believe in God before. I was really skeptical. I went through a period where I did tarot cards and stuff like that, and I honestly believed in, you know, the sort of the Jungian cosmic unconscious, and that seemed like, okay, well, that's a way to explain woo without making it about God.
And, dream and interpretation.
It, yeah, yeah. Yeah, and it, so it took a while to get past that to a more skeptical perspective. So I think atheism can lead to skepticism.
And vice versa.
And vice versa. Well, I think that's about all the time we have. I want to thank all of our guests, Greta and Chelsea and Tim and Jack.
This was a lot of fun. I'm really glad that you got invited to this conference. Thank you, guys. This has been really great.
Yeah, this has been great. Thank you for coming out. We will hopefully have a good enough solid sound quality to put up this panel on our website, geekswithoutgod.com, next Tuesday. Yes. Oh, yeah, we got buttons.
Please come down because we have tons and stickers and all kinds of fun stuff.
We brought swag.
You can like us on Facebook. You can follow us on Twitter at Geeks Without God. And
follow all our great panelists on Twitter. We'll have their information on our website as well as links to their websites and everything else they do. Obviously, you people should already know about them, but just in case you don't, just in case you're listening to this for the first time, you people out there, in the ether,
jeez, Tim,
in the partially evil internet,
you people listening to this podcast who haven't heard about this podcast yet.
All right, we're signing off now. We're just done. Everybody, clap.
Thank you.
Thanks to the organizers of Skeptech for inviting us. We're not worthy!
We're geeks, without God. We're geeks without God. We don't recognize moral authority. We don't accept divine superiority. We're geeks, without God.
Until next time, you can find us blogging at geekswithoutgod.com. You can follow us on Twitter at geekswithoutgod, and you can even like us on Facebook.
We're geeks, we're geeks without God. We're geeks without God. We're geeks, without God.
Shh, he's trying to talk.